Good evening. This is Green Egg editor and publisher Ariel Montserrat. Good evening. This is Green Egg editor and publisher Ariel Montserrat, and you are listening to the Green Egg Radio Hour. I am here with my co-host Sylvie Selou, who is our Green Egg webmistress. And tonight's guest is Tony, I hope I get this right, Tony Mirzwicki. And he has a book that he's going to talk about, that he's written about ancient Greek and Egyptian magic and ritual. And we're going to introduce him in just a few minutes. First, I just want to do brief news item, news of the day item. Apparently, there was a group of officers who were out during the daytime, off duty, joyriding. And the problem is they were like in downtown San Francisco where traffic never moves, and they were going 100 miles per hour. And then the guy, one of the guys, posts the video on the internet, which of course was discovered by his coworkers. And when asked to give an explanation, then compounded the problem by saying, well, we were all drunk. So anyway, there you have it. Anyway, so Sylvie, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. Do you want to start things off and tell us a little bit about Tony and his biography?
Sure. Well, as you said, tonight our guest is Tony Mirzwicki. Is that correct? The correct pronunciation, I hope.
Mirzwicki.
And he'll be discussing his book about ancient Greek and Egyptian magic, as well as his work as an editor at Wikipedia. Tony's been practicing ceremonial magic since 1990, and he's been running regular workshops and rituals reenacting ancient magical practices. The workshops and rituals are both in the United States and on the East Coast of Australia. They were first started in 2001.
Tony is the author of Greco-Egyptian Magic, Everyday Empowerment, and a forthcoming primer, Reconstructing Classical Greek Religion. He has contributed to various anthologies and magazines, and he gives regular guest appearances and lectures at various pagan, witchcraft, and New Age events, and has been on television and radio shows.
Tony has completed 3 degrees at the University of Sydney, Master of Arts, Bachelor of Engineering, and Bachelor of Science. He served a 3-year term on the board of directors for Cherry Hill Seminary from August 29, 2008 to September 30, 2011, of which roughly half in the capacity of secretary. Tony is originally from Sydney, Australia, and currently lives with his wife, Joanne, in Huntington Beach, California.
So welcome, Tony. How are you tonight?
Thank you. I'm doing really well. I really appreciate being on your show, the second historic show, I might add.
Pardon me? It's the what now?
It's the second historic show.
Ah, historic show? Yes.
Yeah.
That's true. You're our first guest in our new show. That's very true. So, did you want to... Tony, did you want to start off talking about Wikipedia or Greco-Egyptian magic or something else?
I was just going to make a slight correction. I actually do editing work for a company called Pendrag Publishing. My wife Joanne actually does design and layout for them. I was going to have a chat about them later.
Mm-hmm.
Have been sort of involved in Wikipedia. There was a bit of an incident a few weeks ago that I'm quite happy to have a chat about. But you know, the editing work that I'm known for is the editing that I've done for Pendrag Publishing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. Okay. Well, thank you for clarifying that.
That's okay.
Yeah. So did you want to talk about Pendrag a little bit, or?
If you like. Pendrag Publishing is a small publishing company that's devoted to covering subjects like traditional witchcraft, warp cunning, the art of cunning folk, and the ancient mystery traditions. The point is that there are so many avenues out there for Wiccan authors to get their works into print that Peter Padden, who actually owns Pendrag Publishing, decided that he wanted to give folks a bit of a go. So a number of Peter's books are in print. And on top of that, there are people like Veronica Kummer, who's been a witch for 20 years. She's a priestess of the old forest craft tradition for over 14 years and has a close association with the Fae. Mm-hmm. She's got a couple of books out. There's Radomir Ristich, who wrote a book on traditional Balkan traditional witchcraft. So it's a system of witchcraft that not many people out here in the West are familiar with, so it's quite an exciting book to read to get an insight into how people do things in the Balkans. Then there's Robert Artison, who's written books on traditional witchcraft. He's got The Flaming Circle and The Horn of Evenwood out. Ellen Hopman, who is a master herbalist and a druid priestess, mm-hmm. has written a text called Scottish Herbs and Fairy Lore. And there's also Scott Michael Stenwick, who has written a book called Mastering the Mystical Heptarchy, which is a book on practicing certain aspects of Enochian magic. And he's also written a fiction book called Arcana. So he kind of crosses over between occult stuff and fiction stuff. Then we have a number of fiction writers, people like Doug Roberts, who is a corrections officer who practices in Sartre, and he's written a book called Ragnarok Rising, The Awakening. It's basically about the zombie apocalypse, but he uses his knowledge of work as a corrections officer and his knowledge of the Sartre and injects those into the novel. Then there's Claudia Dillaire, who wrote The Wrath of the Moon, which is a book set in ancient Egypt, and she incorporates a hell of a lot of material about ancient Egypt. So reading the book is almost an education. Then there's S.P. Hendrick, who's written a number of texts. There's the Glastonbury Chronicles series, and there's also the Tales of the Dark Sidhe. I've probably mispronounced that. It's all basically Celtic British stuff. And then, of course, there's Ben Reeder, who wrote the Demon's Apprentice series. So there's a whole lot of occult texts out there, and a number of fiction texts have a significant occult component in them. So, again, books that aren't quite mainstream texts but will hopefully be of interest to many within our community. Mm-hmm. So wife's been doing design and layout for Pendrag Publishing for quite a few years now, and I've come on board for a few books on a contract basis to do some editing work for them, and the quality of their books is really, really good.
Otherwise,
you wouldn't be involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've reviewed some of Pendrag Publishing's books. Ellen Everett Hopman. We've done a whole lot of hers in the last 6 years or so.
Yeah, she's got some amazing stuff. I should add that my wife doesn't do design and layout, but she works on the covers as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to give her full credit for all the work that she does.
Yes, yes.
She's a very talented lady.
Mm-hmm. So how did you come to write a book? How did you yourself come to write a book?
I've got a background in ceremonial magic. I've been practicing since 1990, so it's basically Golden Dawn type magic, a little bit of Thelemic magic, a bit of Chaos magic, and 11, 12 years ago I found myself being drawn to progressively more ancient systems of magic, and I eventually came across the Greek magic papyri, which were discovered in the very early 1800s. And were only translated in their entirety in the mid-1980s. They're basically magical texts that go back to late antiquity. So we're looking at a period of between the 10th century BC and the 5th century AD. And they're basically a whole collection of spells. So what I do is I dip into these spells and work with them, show how people can work with them. Because when you first go through some of these ancient spells, they can be a little bit daunting. So I basically show people how they can navigate through it. So it's a system of magic that is slowly enjoying a bit of a resurgence, and more people are dipping into it. And I'm particularly drawn to it because it's typical of the philosophical and religious movements of the time. It's a hybrid system, so it incorporates numerous influences. So as the name implies, there are Greek and Egyptian influences, but there's also Sumerian, Babylonian, and Jewish influences, and a very light sprinkling of Christianity. It's all jumbled together.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the spells are written in Koine Greek, which means common Greek. It's the Greek that the New Testament was written in, so we know how to pronounce all the words of power, and in the system of magic, you have to be able to nail the pronunciations to make the magic work. So
wow.
That's why I'm so drawn to it.
Yeah. That must have been quite something to research.
It took a lot of work to research it all, but it's been incredibly rewarding. It's changed my life in many respects. It's enabled me to travel, run workshops, meet some absolutely amazing people on two continents. It brought my wife and myself together, it brought me to a new country. As you can tell from my accent, I was brought up in Sydney. I lived in Sydney all my life. I never expected to move to the United States, but there you are. You always have to be open to possibilities, and exciting things can start to manifest in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably many opportunities have been missed by people because they didn't jump on the wagon and you know, go with it.
Exactly. That's exactly how spirit works.
Mm-hmm.
You're given various opportunities, you're given messages and the like, and if you turn your back on them, they eventually start to fade away and you lose them. You always have to be flexible and aware of opportunities as they manifest.
So did you want to tell us a little bit about what's happening at Wikipedia and explain a little bit about that?
The whole Wikipedia situation was rather upsetting because what happened was that in mid-November I was made aware of a number of pending deletions from Wikipedia. And so I sent out notices, and a number of other people sent out notices as well. And the whole situation was wonderfully summarized by Christine Kramer in her blog on November the 20th. What was happening at the time was that people like Patricia Monaghan, Maha Nightmare, Lucia Teish, Louis Martini, David J. Brown, Matthew Abelson, Kenny Klein, who you were talking about earlier on, Donald Michael Craig, Lasara Firefox, Raven Grimassi, and Barbara Ruhl Canizares were targeted for deletion. Ian Corrigan and David J. Brown wound up being deleted roughly at that time, and several months beforehand, Ted Andrews and Denny Sargent were deleted. And they were deleted on the grounds of not being sufficiently notable or significant. And in the case of someone like Ted Andrews, I mean, the guy had something like 14 books out, and one of them sold 400,000 copies. You know, I mean, how is that not notable or not significant? And it seemed that there was one editor in particular who described himself as a humanist, who seemed to have this ongoing vendetta with the pagan community, and he took it upon himself to start deleting articles on the basis of being insufficiently notable or significant. And in all fairness, some of the articles weren't written as well as they could have been. So what happened was that the people who already were editors, who were, shall we say, friendly to the pagan community, climbed on board and started to fix up those articles, tighten them up, and a number of other people became Wikipedia editors and, again, worked on tightening those articles up so that they wouldn't be deleted. But, you know, despite that, we still lost a couple of articles. But the situation does seem to be dying down a little bit, but at least the community's become aware of the issue. We know that there are individuals who are targeting our community, and we have to be vigilant and aware of it. You know, it's taken us a lot to have the rights that we have, and it would be a shame if we lost them. And but at least, you know, in times of adversity, our community will come together.
Yeah.
So that is quite heartening.
That's really, I mean, I know a lot of these people, and it's just, I mean, I don't understand how one person can just go and delete things like that. I mean, is there no oversight, or...?
Very minimal oversight. The way that Wikipedia works is that you've got all these people out there who can upload articles. There are guidelines that those articles are supposed to adhere to. But then anyone can come in and edit those articles, change things. And much of the time, it works really, really well. And people are motivated by good, and they upload information, you know, for the good of other people. But every once in a while, you're going to have someone coming along who is malicious. Now, the thing with Wikipedia is that it's not recognized as a reliable reference source for academic use. However, a lot of people use it as a first point of call, a first reference point. And it's gotten to the stage now where I've heard stories of teachers who can't be bothered doing research for their pupils. They just go on Wikipedia. And if one of their students comes up with information that doesn't appear on Wikipedia, then they'll be marked down for presenting information the teacher can't readily identify. So Wikipedia is generating a consensus reality of sorts. There was also another story years ago of someone who had a note attached to Wikipedia saying that they had terrorist connections. So this person tried coming into Canada, and they were held up for many, many hours and interrogated purely because some malicious person had added to their Wikipedia profile that they had terrorist connections, and it just wasn't true.
Oh, my God. In this day and age, that's just really, really just evil.
Yeah.
In the case of the editor who was part of the pagan community, he would sometimes delete footnotes first, and then he'd come back into the article and say that a lot of these claims that are being made are unsupported, and then he'd delete huge slabs of the article.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this deliberate campaign by him to target various pagan articles. And the thing is, that if someone is trying to research the pagan community, you know, if there are dozens and dozens of articles there, then you can see that the move is significant. Whereas if most of them wind up being deleted, people are going to not bother.
Right.
So I think the importance of this can't be understated, and that's why so many of us were concerned. We were getting information out there, and then you had Dr. Christine Kramer writing her blog to summarize the whole thing, which was wonderful. So a lot of people were then able to come on board and become informed as to what was happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So what can we do about this? I mean, is there anything that we can do about this?
Well, Wikipedia has its rules, and articles have to adhere by those rules. So it's a matter of tightening up all the articles, making sure that the supporting information that we have comes from reliable third-party sources. None of it seems to be self-promotional stuff. And then just upload the stuff and hope for the best. And then we have to be vigilant and see if anything is being targeted for deletion. And in mid-November, we had a large number of pagan leaders who were being targeted for deletion. And as you said, a number of these people were our friends. They're people that we love and respect and look up to. And it was very painful to see them being targeted.
Yeah, I mean, and they've given their entire lives towards helping to develop the pagan community and recover,
exactly.
Rituals and magic and things like that. And I mean, like Ian Corrigan comes to mind, you know, somebody who just kind of has been quietly working away, and he's been here since forever, you know?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, he's very prominent within the Druid community. He's got a number of self-published books out. He's a musician, and he's a lovely guy.
Yes.
I know the guy, and I like him.
Yeah.
So, it was painful to see his article deleted as well.
Mm-hmm.
I had the good fortune of meeting up with Ian on a couple of my trips out this summer. Joanne and I made 3 trips out to Starwood, and a few months ago, Ian and his wife actually came out to California, so we met up with them for dinner. We actually had photographs uploaded to our Facebook page, so it was great catching up with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So basically, what we need are more individuals to become editors, to monitor issues, create more pages for our pagan leaders. We basically have to make sure that the pages that we have today, because it's a lot easier to preserve a page than it is to resurrect a page once it's been deleted, and then hopefully we can have even more significant individuals uploaded in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be okay. So if we wanted to become an editor, what do we need to know?
There are guidelines on Wikipedia that you can go through. If anyone is interested, they can always contact me and I can point them in the right direction. There are people out there who have been editing for Wikipedia for many, many years. One tip that I will give people is to not use their real names. You will notice that the existing Wikipedia editors tend to use pseudonyms, and once you have a pseudonym, don't let people know that pseudonym actually represents you, because some people can get very, very emotional about material that's posted on Wikipedia, and I've heard a couple of horror stories, only from the one source though, so I don't really want to repeat those, but the source was telling me that it's important to not use your real name, so it's one bit of advice I'd like to impart.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's about where it stands then. It's just that they've been trained to delete. This guy's been trained to delete it, delete us, and
yes, that's basically what it's done. It seems to be calming down at the moment, but we don't want to be lulled into a false sense of security. There was talk about higher ups in Wikipedia, their paid staff being informed as to what was happening, and they said that they were concerned as to whether they actually do anything or not is another matter. But I think if we want to get things done, we really have to monitor the situation ourselves. But at the time, a lot of people felt sufficiently motivated to become editors and also keep an eye on what was happening and give feedback to others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. It seems like it's always the same old story with pagans, is if we want it done, we just have to get out there and do it ourselves and monitor and,
yep.
try to change things. I don't know. We've just continued to be this fringe religion to most people, and I don't know. I don't know if that's going to change. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, it's not going to, in my opinion, it's not going to change unless we make it change.
Mm-hmm.
And like he's saying, we have to be vigilant on this and put forth a real effort.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree totally. We have to be vigilant, and I think it is important to maintain a presence on a site like Wikipedia, because it is mainstream. We don't want to go back into the shadows. We fought our way into the mainstream and we should stay there.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, man. I don't know. It just... and, when I became pagan, I lived in Northern California and up in the San Francisco Bay Area. And it was just much different there. I mean, even in my workplace, which was pretty conservative... I was still out of the broom closet.
Mm-hmm.
And then my husband and I retired here to the mountains of Tennessee up in the Bible Belt almost 8 years ago. And we've had to be in the closet about everything the whole time. I mean, I cannot wear my pentacle out on the street when I go into town to go shopping. and it's a town of 1,400 people, so it's a real small town. And pretty much it's the same way for most everybody here in the South, even pagans living in Atlanta, which is a huge city. I know of at least one family that had trouble in school when the school found out that the family was pagan. It was really pretty hurtful, to the point where her little boy developed PTSD. He was having nightmares and things like that, you know?
That's terrible.
Yeah, and I don't know. I just, for a long time, I've been racking my brain trying to think, you know, what do we do? The problem is that most of the people that think that witchcraft is evil and that we're evil people are people who are so steeped in their faith-based religion that you can't reason with them.
Well, and one thing I would like to remind everyone about is that back in 2010, if you recall, Harvard hosted a symposium.
Oh, yeah.
Where these radical religionists came in and were actually teaching on how to hunt witches.
Yeah.
So this has gone beyond the South. I've always said the disease of the South has spread.
Mm-hmm.
Here it's hit Wikipedia now. We have a lot of pagans, witches, Wiccans, what have you, that will say, well, you know, you don't want to harm anyone, you don't want to fight, you don't want to do this and you don't want to do that. But our very history teaches us that in order to establish something, you have to fight for it. We have warrior pagans out there that know how to do this, and they don't harm anyone physically, but they have the intellect and the know-how to use whatever means is in front of them to effect change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think every pagan who has I don't care if it's music, if it's things like the radio broadcast or using your video camera, use it and fight, because we're not going to be able to stand unless we do this.
Yeah. We're lucky that we have a number of people who are representing our community in interfaith work. So on a national level, we've got people like Selena Fox and the Lady Liberty League who are representing pagans whenever they are subjected to any sort of adversity. On an international level, we have people like Patrick McCollum who are rubbing shoulders with various religious leaders around the world and are doing our community proud. But the thing is that I think all of us who are able to should try to live our lives out of our broom closets as much as we can and just live our lives well, just show that we're like everyone else. The only difference between us and others is that our belief systems are different. You know, Australia is a very secular country, and it was far easier for me to live out of the broom closet than it has been in America. And the impression that a lot of Australians have about California is that it's the home of weird religious cults. You know, there was Heaven's Gate, and I was basically expecting everyone to be into crystals and ascended masters and pyramid energy and everything else. And instead, I found myself living in Orange County, which I like to think of as the Bible Belt of Southern California. We have more churches than 7-Elevens. It's incredibly conservative here.
Sounds like our area.
It wasn't always that way. California, I mean, you're right on, Tony. California always was. I grew up in California. I grew up in the Hollywood Hills, for criminy sakes, and then moved to San Francisco, you know, the two centers of California that's, you know, the joke is that they tipped America and all the fruits and nuts fell into California, you know. And I loved it. It was so that you could walk out on the street, you might see absolutely anything, and you would. And it was fun. Yeah. I mean, you know. And then suddenly these Christian dominionists got going, and they've taken over whole towns of California. And it's bewildering to me, because Bible Belt and California just, they don't fit together in my mind. I mean, you know, for 50 years I lived in California. I grew up there. I remember when Malibu Beach was nothing. There was nothing there, absolutely nothing. And starving artists lived up in the Malibu Hills. And there was one little fish diner or something, you know, on the coast. That was it. Now you've got extremely wealthy movie stars and other celebrities living there. Anyway, it's California's gone through a whole lot of changes.
Yeah. Just a little bit of historical trivia. The area that I live in, Orange County, used to be known as Gospel Swamps.
Oh, my, yeah. That doesn't sound good.
No, it doesn't.
I actually wanted to change my location on Facebook to Gospel Swamps, but it wouldn't let me. But I also think that it's important for all pagans to stand together on this issue, regardless of their own tradition. So too many of us identify as, you know, either Wiccans or Reconstructionists or heathens or ceremonial magicians or this or that. And that may be true, but ultimately we all fit underneath the pagan umbrella, and it's only if we all stand together that we're going to be counted and we're going to have a little bit of political clout. I was actually going to talk about something rather interesting that happened just a few days ago, if I can.
Yes.
On Tuesday, December the 4th, 2012, I went to an arts gallery in Venice Beach. I mean, you're familiar with Venice Beach? It's called the L&M Arts Gallery. And the thing is that they have a Marshall Chronicles exhibit. So it's the writings of Bradbury. So in order to celebrate that, they brought in an occult artist, musician, filmmaker called Brian Butler to perform an Aleister Crowley ritual called the Bartable Working. And it was advertised in some of the local magazines. Bartable is the spirit of Mars. That's how it ties into the theme of the exhibition. So Brian Butler was going to play the role of the chief magus. And the plan was to have actor James Franco as the material basis. So he would stand in a triangle and be the receptacle for the spirit of Mars to come in. However, at the last minute, he couldn't turn up, so another actor called Christopher Emerson wound up being substituted. Also in attendance was Ruth Sia, who's known for her appearance in Twilight New Moon. She played the role of Magus Adjuvant, and there was also another female who was Assistant Magus. I should probably give a little bit of background. The first time that the Bartable evocation was performed was on Tuesday, May 9, 1910, in England. And in this endeavour, Aleister Crowley was assisted by Australian violinist Layla Waddell, Victor Neuberg, and the person apparently requesting the evocation, Commander Guy Montague Marston, who was some sort of intelligence asset for the Naval Intelligence Division of the Admiralty with connections to Russia and earlier in Africa. So Marston's involvement confirms that this was no casual experiment in spirit communication. It seems that the purpose of the ritual event was simply that of espionage. They wanted to know from the spirit whether nation would rise up against nation. So Victor Neuberg stood in the triangle, and he was the material basis, and the spirit of Bartable came into him, and it wound up communicating that war would come about within 5 years, and it would contain two conflicts, one with Germany and one with Turkey, and that both nations would be destroyed. So we don't know how Commander Marston felt about the evocation, but within a few months, the intelligence forces of the British Empire wound up changing their focus from their traditional enemies, which were France and Russia, to a new enemy, Germany. And war with Germany actually began in 1914. And a few months later, war began with Turkey. And the result was that both of those nations were destroyed. So the predictions provided by Bartable were very, very successful. In 1946, the Bartable working was performed again. this time by Jet Propulsion Laboratory rocket scientist and Crowley protege Jack Parsons. Jack Parsons was sufficiently notable that he's actually had a crater on the moon named after him.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole story is outlined in a book by British journalist Russell Miller called Barefaced Messiah, The True Story of L. Ron Hubbard. But the important facts are that in August 1945, L. Ron Hubbard, before he formed Scientology, wound up befriending Parsons and he moved into his Pasadena mansion. Parsons at the time was renting rooms in his mansion to tenants who were either atheists or those of a bohemian disposition. Hubbard wound up getting involved with Parsons' 21-year-old girlfriend, Sarah Northrup, but despite that, Parsons was still impressed with Hubbard. So the three of them wound up getting into a business partnership in which they invested nearly their entire savings. The vast majority of the money was actually contributed by Parsons. So the plan was for Hubbard and Sarah to buy yachts in Miami, sail them to the West Coast, and sell them for a profit. Hubbard, however, decided that he wanted to take a world cruise with Sarah. Parsons attempted to recover his money by obtaining an injunction, but they wound up sailing anyway. So when Parsons found out, he performed an evocation of Bart Sabell in a Miami, Florida hotel room. And the end result of that evocation was that it caused a storm at sea, which was sufficiently powerful to force Hubbard and Sarah back to shore. A week later, the joint business was dissolved. Parsons only received a small value promissory note from Hubbard, and he wound up having to sell his mansion to developers afterwards to recoup his losses. So to summarize, the Baths for Working is a serious, powerful ritual that can provide accurate military information and also raise devastating storms. It's not a ritual to be trifled with.
Mm-hmm.
So on December the 4th, the advertisement for the Working stated that the ritual was going to be a reinterpretation of this historical performance, Butler will conjure Baths for the Spirit of Mars. So there was this strong impression given that Butler would be reinterpreting a genuine ritual to present a genuine ritual. So a lot of people turned up with the expectation that they were going to see a real, genuine ritual. As the Working progressed, it quickly became evident that we were looking at performance art, not a bona fide magical ritual. The circle and triangle of art, with its sigil of Barzabal, reproduced magnificently. The robes were really nice. The required weapons were there. Some of the tools were there, but not all of them. Portions of the dialogue were taken straight from the Crowley Working, and the Crowley Working is available in its entirety online if anyone wants to check it out. And a lot of us noticed that there was no real energy raised. The Bartsville possession, when it came about, was clearly simulated, and it was simulated to look like a demonic possession. It was like watching a scene out of The Exorcist or some other B-grade horror movie. A number of the non-magical folk there showed disrespect by chatting through the ritual, giggling away. At the end of the ritual, there was no closing or banishing rite. And then after it was over, people just walked through the ritual area to get a better look and to take photos.
Yeah.
I didn't see anyone touching the magical tools, but it left me feeling really, really uncomfortable. Having people just wandering through a ritual area. But the thing is that there are a number of magical groups in the LA area, including two Thelemic groups. There's the Star Sapphire Lodge and the Golden Lotus Oasis. And as far as I know, not one person from those Thelemic groups was contacted about the event. So my opinion is that there's an ethical consideration. I think that the Thelemic groups should have been contacted as a matter of courtesy, and it should also have been made clear that the ritual was only performance art and not a genuine ritual, and attendees should have been asked to be respectful.
Mm-hmm.
The only positive thing that I can see about the whole thing is that people who would otherwise never get to see a Crowley ritual actually got to see one. So the whole Working actually raises a couple of issues. So firstly, is it ethical to present a sacred ritual as performance art? Should we be consulting groups that are likely to be offended? I mean, I think that that's an important consideration. If you take a group's sacred right and present it, I mean, you should at least get permission to do so.
Yeah, I think so.
I agree.
I agree with that
because...
Crowley was no stranger to performance art. He actually wrote The Rites of Eleusis, which was a series of seven invocations to the seven planets, seven classical planets, I should say. So the whole thing was designed to perform publicly, and I don't think there'd be an issue in performing something like that. But once you start getting hold of a serious sacred ritual and performing it publicly, then it's like you're defiling it. My opinion. I'm not really a spokesman for people in the Thelemic community. It's just my opinion.
Yeah.
But one other thing that really springs to mind is that a lot of people have this impression that if they get hold of a magical text and they recite magic words in that text, things will happen. Or if they perform a ritual, things will happen. The Barcible working is a clear example that despite being dressed up in robes, casting a circle, doing all the right things, it is possible to get no result whatsoever because the thing that was missing was will.
Mm-hmm.
There was no willpower, there was no intent, and as a result, the ritual didn't work. So to me, it's a clear lesson that if you pick up a magic book, it's not like things are going to happen just by flipping through it.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
It's a whole lot more than that.
Yeah, so the ritual was clearly upsetting to the Thelemic community, but again, I think it has broader ramifications as well, because if someone's willing to get hold of a ritual from the Thelemic community, they may well start dipping into rituals from other traditions as well and presenting those in a fashion that's not appropriately sensitive. So I just wanted to share that. That's just something that happened in the last week in the LA area that's been fairly significant for quite a few of us.
Yeah. And other people share your opinion as well, I'm assuming.
I've been in contact with a few people about it. And people are concerned that it was presented as a general ritual, but it was only performance art, and that it wasn't run respectfully.
There's another thing here, too, which I believe that when you do magic, that it can, if somebody else does your ceremony or your ritual and they don't really know what they're doing or they're doing it as for a different reason, like performance art, I think it taints the magic. Now, that's
I agree with you. Actually, Israel Regardi wrote something very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
He stated that if you get hold of an elegant ritual that was put together by someone else and work it will never be as effective as
mm-hmm.
something that's very simple that you
mm-hmm.
have put together, that you fully understand and comes from your heart. Because to make magic work, you've got to have magical intent. You've got to involve your emotions. If it's something that you know and understand,
mm-hmm.
then it's something that you can make work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
It's like picking up a tool that you've never used before, and you have no idea even what it's supposed to do. You know, and
yeah.
if you can't envision it, then how? then how? How can you use it?
Yeah.
Ooh. And I don't know. I don't know of any magic to. I mean, I know. Of course, you can do protection spells for your magic, but. Then there are the individual circumstances that are pretty egregious, like the one that you just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
How do you undo that? Is there a way? Is there magic for that?
Mm.
I went there with a clear expectation of something happening. I actually anointed my third eye area with a little bit of tobacco oil because
mm-hmm.
in the Golden Dawn tradition,
mm-hmm.
Tobacco and chili are aspects of Tamaz. So I thought, okay, I'll go in keeping with the ritual, just to open myself up to energies, but there was nothing there. I caught up with a friend of mine at the end of the rite, and he actually pulled out one of those electronic cigarettes and lit up just to get some tobacco into him because sitting going there expecting something and nothing happened. We all felt flat and empty at the end of it. Like, I can't talk for everyone who was there, but just the people who I spoke to sort of felt that way. But there was nothing really to shield yourself from. There was no energy raised. Yeah, as performance art, it was pretty cool. The if people check out either my blog or my Facebook page, then they'll see. And there are also a couple of videos that have been uploaded to YouTube as well. You'll see that the ritual area was absolutely beautiful. There was a wonderful circle of art. There was an absolutely wonderful triangle of manifestation. It was all put together to be very aesthetically pleasing. It was all lovely to look at, but that wasn't why most of us were there. We were expecting a genuine ritual. And just further to what we were saying before, I think it's always important to be respectful of any rituals that are put together. Once you start to change them or bastardize them, I hope that term doesn't offend anyone, then you're really being disrespectful to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, that reminds me of a lot of what we see coming out of Hollywood. Anytime they make these movies and they present any magical practitioner as something silly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm glad that these people, at least, you know, it looked nice, but the disrespect is still there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And some people take their art to the point where it's devastating to the pagan community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen shows where some of them I just do not appreciate because I watch it and I was like, you know, that's not correct.
Mm-hmm.
And it instills fear. And this fear factor that is just so attached to the pagan community by people who know nothing about it, I really wish that could be eradicated.
Mm-hmm.
I totally agree.
I've just never seen anything in any type of magical workings that is to be feared, and even within the pagan community we have a lot of fear going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was looking at Tony's site and noticed, you know, he's got the on his lectures page the Greek vows and Hellenistic magic, and even talks about cursings and hauntings in pop culture. And that really stood out to me because I thought, well, you know, that is a good thing to talk about. He mentions hauntings and demons and gods and things like that. And I think there's, even within our pagan communities, there's a large misunderstanding as to what is bad and what is good.
Yeah.
And fear is, and until we get rid of it within our community,
mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure that outside the community, it you know, it's going to be gotten rid of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, sometimes
I think, you know, maybe I don't want them to really know all about what we're doing because, you know, they could take our magic and use it against us, or then you get Child Protective Services involved, or, you know, there's all kinds of stuff. So,
well, you know, they are a lot of people are actually using magic and they don't realize it.
Yeah. Oh,
course,
well,
you know,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think more harmful magic is done unconsciously than anything else.
Well, it's been in the news. You've seen what happened with DC-40.
Yeah.
A lot of Christianity, they are practicing magic. They know just enough to focus and pray and mm-hmm. direct their intent, but once it's out there, it's just wild.
Yeah.
You know, and it does more harm than it does good. And they, you know, and they really have the nerve to call us evil.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you and I talked, Sylvia, a while back. I was researching to do a series of articles on the Christian Dominionists, and came across some website where these three guys went to Stonehenge to work magic against the ley lines and against us, against pagans and witches. And he's describing this whole thing. He never uses the word magic, but he's got this whole ritual that he did. And it was destructive, harmful magic is what he was doing.
Yes.
And, you know, the absurdity of somebody using magic to destroy somebody because they're using magic is just beyond belief. But there you have it.
Tony, could I ask you a question while I've got you?
Sure.
And, you know, this has to do kind of with the fear factor. Would you describe to us what a daemon is and tell us if we should be afraid of them?
Hold on. Before the Christians came along, the Greeks had a term, daemon, D-A-I-M-O-N. Now, the thing is, a daemon means a spirit. It has no connotation of good or evil. It's a totally neutral term. Having said that, some spirits can be thought of good. Some spirits can be thought of as evil. However, once the Christians came along, they corrupted the term daemon into demon. So all spirits were thought of as automatically evil, and it doesn't really work that way. It's much the same thing with god energies. Every god energy has a positive aspect and a negative aspect to it. Like for instance, we were talking about the Mars energy before. When people think of the Mars energy, they think of warfare, they think of destruction. But Mars energy can also be used for drive and determination. There's also a protective component to it, you know, setting up protective walls around cities and the like. So no energy is either exclusively good or exclusively evil. You know, and it's the same thing with spirits. Spirits tend to be, you know, they're very rarely either totally bad or totally evil, but the Christians tend to look at anything that's not Christian as being evil. Yet even in the writings of St. Paul, he basically states that the gods of the pagans are all demons.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's been demonized.
Yeah, and the evil, they see evil outside of themselves, whereas we see it inside of ourselves, our shadows. And
yeah, we take responsibility for our actions.
And I think this to me is one of the most destructive aspects of Christianity, is it doesn't teach you to look at your own shadow.
Yeah, Christians tend to use demons and Satan as a scapegoat. Whenever they do anything bad, it's, well, the devil made me do it. You know, if I do something wrong, it's a case of, well, I stuffed up, I've got to work on myself. I don't look for an excuse outside myself. One of the fundamental differences between Christians and non-Christians. You know, Christians don't really have a sense of personal responsibility.
Mm-mm.
I'm talking in broad brush strokes.
Right. Yeah, of course.
Well, it's obvious. Those broad brush strokes, I mean, they cover a lot of area, and we can see it even right now within our society from everything from politics right down to someone's personal life. You know,
yeah.
Not taking responsibility, and the mantra they use, well, I'm forgiven, translated means I can just do whatever in hell I want to, and I'm forgiven.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, do they.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, that's no good.
No.
I don't want to offend any Christians or anything, but, you know.
Well, and then the arrogance about it. It's,
yeah.
You know, when how many times, well, as Sylvie, you and I living in Tennessee, how many times have we read about a gay or lesbian couple getting burned out of their home, you know? I also know a couple of pagans that's happened to, too. And
mm-hmm.
And it's frightening, it's terrifying, and I don't think you'd ever feel safe again if that ever happened, you know? But but they're proud of having done this. They're proud of having destroyed the evil. And
yes, they're taught that in the churches, too. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know. Of course, you know,
they listen.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
They do.
Yeah.
Mean sheep, they have dog teeth, you know.
Dog teeth, yes. And again, you know, I've known some really, really fine Christian people.
Yeah.
But those aren't the ones that you read about in the news that are doing very invasive things, I think. They're, you know, advocating no abortion in the case of rape or incest. Let's let the woman make that decision. It's her life, okay? But they want to force their religion on all of us, and they don't see that they're doing that, and they think they're being really patriotic Americans, but they're anything but. They're walking all over the Constitution.
They think they're being persecuted if someone stands up and says no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the best term that I've seen used for this particular kind of Christian is Christian supremacist. You know, they don't want so much a theocracy, at least for now, but they want to be have, you know, favored status because they deserve it, I guess.
Well, as you know, I run a lot of articles on the Pinnacle Project, and I follow witch huntings.
Mm-hmm.
And the missionaries going overseas to Africa and other countries, and they don't just, it's not just in this on this continent.
Mm-hmm.
It is worldwide. They want world domination.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Taking people's native practices and teaching that it's evil. We're not going to have peace on earth at all with things like that, because each culture is rich, very rich in,
mm-hmm.
with its traditions, and there's good in them.
Mm-hmm.
And once that's destroyed, then we're left with nothing.
Well, yeah, and that's part of what's happening with our society, I think, is this is part of why it's falling apart, is because we don't, you know, indigenous people have long practiced ways of getting in touch with their shadow and of really developing an intimate relationship with nature, which is healing and sustains you. So many of these things have been taken from us by social engineering, I think, for one. I think the powers that be do a lot of social engineering. But it's almost like we're living in this one-dimensional world now, where we're consumers, and that's, you know, we work and we consume, and that's it. Whereas thousands of years ago, when we lived in little tribes, we were strongly connected to each other, and
mm-hmm.
had to be for survival.
Just going back to Christianity for a minute,
mm-hmm.
when we go through the Gospels present a Jesus who came and ministered to the sick, to the poor. He hung out with the dregs of society, the, you know,
mm-hmm.
the prostitutes, the drug collectors, and everything else. I think if Christians took Jesus' life as an example and lived their lives like him,
mm-hmm.
we probably wouldn't have the sort of problems that we're having as pagans in society. But Christianity these days seems to be so divorced from the teachings of Jesus and the Gospels that they're almost unrecognizable. You know, the love and the compassion's gone. The tolerance is gone. If we could bring Christianity back to Jesus, I think it'd be much easier for pagans to thrive. I just wanted to get that in before we run out of time.
Oh yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think that's a very important, and I think that's why Jesus came here. I don't have a problem with Jesus at all. I think his teachings make complete sense, and I can really identify with him because most of my life I've hung out with fringe, what you would call fringe people.
Yeah,
but you know, that's where I find the gold, for lack of a better way to put it. But I think that's when he came here. He lived his life. You know, his teachings were his life. You know.
Mm-hmm.
He stood up for what he believed. There's a lot to be learned from his life. And it's been, I really have a hard time understanding the disconnect between love your neighbor, because, you know, what's the most important commandment? Love your neighbor. Between that and hating gays, hating people who believe that abortion is okay, under some circumstances at least. There's just this major disconnect there, and I don't know what to do with it. Are we here?
Yeah, I'm still here.
You've done 60 seconds.
Where's the music coming from? Oh, well. Anyway, I think it's time for us to wrap up our show.
Yeah.
Okay,
I have no idea what's going on with that. Anyway,
thank you so much for having me on the show. I think as pagans we should get back to our roots, tolerate each other, be true to our traditions, practice traditions, you know, as they're first, you know, don't change things around, don't bastardize them, you know, be loving towards each other, everything else. But thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for being on our show, Tony, and I think you had a lot of great things to say. And
Thank you.
We wish you luck in your endeavors.
Thank you very much. I've had a wonderful time.
Okay. And with that, we're closed. Sylvie, do you have any closing thoughts?
Just shout out to Phil Kessler. Thanks for the good wishes.
Okay. Well, good night, everybody. Good night, Tom and Aubrey.
Hey, good night.
Good night.